Welcome back to this week's edition of the Midweek Reality Check with Michael Pinto, where I try to keep Wall Street and your money real.
Okay, so I was at a conference, a panel put together by my friend Adam Taggart. He used to run Wealthion, but now he runs a much better channel called Thoughtful Money. And I highly recommend everybody go and pay for the replay of that event. It was like 9 hours of me and Danielle DiMartino Booth and Lacey Hunt. Some pretty good speakers were there. But in case you don't get a chance, you didn't attend the conference and you don't get a chance to pay for the replay, I thought I'd just go over briefly my highlights of what I tried to get across in the conference. So the first thing I talked about was the rate hikes always work with a lag. So the Fed funds rate in 2003 went from 1% to 5.25%. And the last hike was July of 2006. A year later, the market peaked, and a year after that, the economy completely fell apart. The global economy fell apart. Well, the current cycle has interest rates going from 0% in March of 22 to the range of 5.25% to 5.5% in July of 23. And if the market were to peak in July of 24, which is not so many months away, unfortunately, and the economy falls apart right around a year after that, it would be all normal. Be right on schedule. So when people say, well, why aren't rate hikes working this time around? No, it's all normal and according to schedule. So have a little more patience. And the reason why this works this way is because positive real Fed funds rate, that's around 2%. So you take nominal Fed funds minus inflation, it's around 2%. You keep it there for around a year. This is, since 2000, every time that happened, we had a recession. So it's about 9 or 10 months. We only have a couple more months to go. Everything seems right on schedule to start really having the poop hit the fan around June, July of this year. Now, continuing, why I think these rate hikes are going to have a problem, starting to negatively affect the economy and the markets. The share of household debt that isn't a mortgage is now 35%. So it was 25% just before the global financial crisis. So we have a much higher percentage of household debt that is floating rate, credit cards, auto loans, and stuff like that. And so that's not locked up in a 30-year mortgage. And that means their net interest income has plunged by $200 billion in this current Fed tightening cycle. Normally, net interest income increases for households as the Fed hikes rates because you get, your 30-year mortgage doesn't really go up. You have a little bit of floating rate debt that does hurt. But you also have money in the bank and you have, dividends can rise as well. But guess what? The opposite has happened this time. The interest you get on bonds and in the bank is not compensating at all for the variable rate that you must pay on your floating rate debt. And by the way, the debt and asset bubbles are worse than ever this time around. So the corporate debt supply has increased by 115% since 2007. It's a record 49% of GDP. Corporate defaults are soaring. We have $1.8 trillion in corporate debt that must be refinanced by the end of 2025. Those refinancing costs are up 45% already. There's a record $1.3 trillion in credit card debt, speaking of those revolving rate loans to households. Delinquencies are up 59% year over year in 2023. It's the highest since 2011. Auto loan delinquencies are the highest in a decade as well. Collateralized loan obligations, which are securitized pools of leveraged loans, they are up to $1.4 trillion today, a 366% increase from $300 billion in 2008. Private credit, which are loans to businesses who can't get a loan from a bank or tap the corporate debt market, totaled $100 billion pre the global financial crisis. Now it's $1.7 trillion. In other words, what's my point here? We have a lot of leverage in the system. And it's not what you hear from the mainstream financial media, who will tell you that, there's no more leverage in the economy anymore. Well, there's no more leverage except outside of corporate debt and household debt, floating rate debt. And also, heading into the next recession, the U.S. is already insolvent. This is a new phenomenon. There's $1 trillion in interest payments. In 2007, before the global financial crisis, the total deficit was $160 billion. Total U.S. debt to GDP is 123%. It was just 60% prior to the global financial crisis. Total non-financial debt to GDP was 227% prior to the global financial crisis. Now it's 263%. The national debt is 733% of revenue. And we're adding 42% to that debt, 42% of our yearly revenue to that debt. 42% of all yearly revenue. Deficits increased by over 200% in the last two recessions. That means we're going to have a $6 trillion deficit. And if you slap a 5% average rate on that, two-thirds of all federal revenue will be spent on interest. And do you want to know why the Fed doesn't really care? I mean, the clown Powell's a clown show. You know, you want to know why the Fed came out today and said, you know, I think inflation is going to be a little hotter than normal. And you know what? I think the unemployment rate is going to be a little bit lower than we first thought. And you know what? I really strongly feel that GDP is going to be stronger than we originally thought. But in spite of all of that, guess what? The Fed says we're going to cut rates three times still. And I think the reason why they need to cut interest rates quickly, rather quickly, despite the inflation not being vanquished, despite the fact that inflation is still a salient issue, is because the U.S. can't afford to pay two-thirds of all revenue on interest. So here's some catalysts for the next recession. The bank term funding program expired on March 11th, and the banking conditions are worse today than they were on March 11th of 2023. So the BTFP program lasted a year. That rescued all these banks. Banks gave their impaired assets, which were mortgage-backed securities and treasuries, to the Fed. The Fed gave them 100% credit, par value, and now that's no longer the case. So I would expect a lot more trouble coming from the regional banking system in the near future. And also on top of that, the reverse repo facility, you know, $2.5 trillion worth of high-powered money, which was sitting fallow at the Fed, that facility should run dry at the end of the second quarter, and that's the removal of liquidity for banks, bonds, and the stock market, and that's when QT really begins to bite. So I'm going to go over some recession indicators that are already in place. You should not ignore these. These are all part of my model, and that is why we are long the market, but we are not over our skis bullish, and neither should you. Manufacturing sector of the economy has contracted for the past 16 months in a row. The index of leading economic indicators has declined for 23 months in a row. The National Federation of Independent Business Optimism Index has 26 consecutive months below the 50-year average of 98. Household survey non-farm payroll report shows job losses over the last 3 months. The U6 unemployment rate rising to 7%, and that includes marginally attached to the workforce people and those that are working part-time for economic reasons. In other words, I'd like to work full-time, but I can't find a good job. The 10-year minus 2-year yield curve spread is the longest inversion in history. Now, this is a near-perfect recession predictor since 1955, with one exception, 1965. There wasn't any recession that year, but GDP did fall from 10% to 0.2%. We've had a positive real Fed funds rate for around a year, and that is, like I said, equals recession every time since 2000. Personal and corporate bankruptcies are up 19 months in a row. Real gross domestic income is down year over year. Bank lending and money supply growth is contracting. You want to ignore all that and just say that, you know, hey, things are great. I think that's a huge problem. And again, not that I'm not sitting here shorting the market. I'm just saying, let's be net long, but let's be very cautious about what we buy. Real estate bubble. We still have these massive problems of a real estate bubble. Home price to income ratio is at a record high. Annual home ownership payments, including taxes and insurance, eat up a record percent of the median household income. Buying a home is 50% more expensive than being a renter. It was 33% prior to the global financial crisis. One quarter of single-family homes are owned by investors. Scary stuff. And that's one bubble that's going to break. The other bubble is the stock market valuations are as I said on the show, Fantasy Island. Price to sales, 2.8. Median is 1.5. Total market cap is of equities as a percentage of GDP, so the value of equities as a percentage of the economy, is far greater than it was at any time in history, and that includes the Great Depression, the NASDAQ bubble, the global financial crisis. The stock market is over 40%, is 40% overvalued using that metric. And yet we see that with all the enthusiasm, we see that the truth lies in the fact that the equal weight S&P 500 is unchanged since the end of 2021. The Dow Jones at transportation average is down 8%. The Russell 2000 is down 15%. The NASDAQ, the almighty NASDAQ, including the AI stocks, they're unchanged since the end of 21. The regional banking index is down 40%, and long-term bonds are down 40% too. So the flood of liquidity that started in 2023, hundreds of billions from the Bank Term Funding Program and $2.5 trillion coming out of the reverse repo facility, that is all going to end, as I said, around June. And that's when I think it's going to be a very interesting time to start putting on some shorts in the portfolio. So again, we are not bearish right now. We are bullish, but we are very bearish on the foundation of the United States. And we are very bearish on the medium to longer term, unfortunately. And I did touch on the banks going coming under a lot of pressure. There's $1.5 trillion in commercial real estate loans coming due in the next 2 years. Interest rates have soared and occupancy rates have plunged to an all-time low. The loans attached to these buildings and edifices are down by 40%. That's a huge problem for the regional banking index, which have 30% of their assets in commercial mortgage-backed securities. So we have withering bank debt, mortgage-backed securities, government debt, corporate debt, credit cards, auto loans, collateralized loan obligations, and private credit, all coming under pressure, especially once this liquidity impulse starts to wane. And even though Powell doesn't really care, inflation's not vanquished, so we're going to have higher long-term rates. This is how it's going to work. Inflation occurs when a market loses faith in a fiat currency's purchasing power. That is when you get inflation. It's usually, you know, inflation is caused by an increase in the money supply, which leads to a deterioration in the market's opinion on what your future purchasing power of your fiat currency will be worth. And that's what has happened in the Hungarian pengo and Weimar Germany and Zimbabwe. It happened all over the globe, all over the planet. And unfortunately, I think that's where we're headed here in the United States. The Fed, the next time we have a recession, is going to have to cut rates substantially and quickly to avoid the refinancing of debt at much higher rates, keeping marginal corporations alive and the deficit from exploding. It cannot do so while inflation is still 50% above its target. It's going to be very, very difficult for the Fed to, you know, put the camel through the needle eye there. So ZERP, QE, TARP, TALF, the Bank Term Funding Program, all work well during deflation, which has been the case for the past 40 years. But during inflation, which we have already severely injured the market's perception of the purchasing power of the dollar, it could and should cause long-term yields to rise the next time the Fed assents to the notion that it has to go back to ZERP and QE and helicopter money. And long-term yields are not controlled by the Fed. They are overwhelmingly controlled by supply and inflation. And that is going to put upward pressure on yields. And then if that's the case, there's going to be no relief from borrowing costs pegged to long-duration bonds. It might be a truncated period where long-duration bonds rally, but the supply that's coming and the inflation that's coming, which is imputed in their actions, could and should send long bond yields higher. And I'll leave you with this thought. You know, the buy and hold crowd, the 60-40 crowd, should be now dead and buried. That notion should be dead and buried. Look, the U.S. stock market today is reminiscent of China's 2007, the Shanghai Index, and Japan's 1989 bubbles. The Shanghai is down 45% since 2007. 17 years of waiting, and you're down 45% in nominal terms. And the Nikkei Dow, just broke even after 35 years. So please keep in mind the importance of following these inflation, deflation, economic cycle, business cycle trends. So you can be long when you need to be long, and out and protected when you need to be out. And owning the proper or the most appropriate sectors and style factors and asset classes, given the macroeconomic conditions. And that is exactly our goal here at Pento Portfolio Strategies.
Thank you so much for listening to this edition of The Reality Check, 5 minutes of sanity in an insane world. Please remember, if you're not already an investor with PPS, you can email me directly using mpento@pentoport.com or call the office using 732-772-9500 to get information about our portfolio services. You should also go to Amazon and order my book, The Coming Bond Market Collapse. Subscribers should contact an investment advisor before acting on any information contained in this podcast. No information on this podcast constitutes an offer to sell or buy any financial instruments or to provide any investment services. Subscribers understand there's an inherent risk in investing. PPS is a registered investment advisor.